Welcome to the Legal Aid New South Wales Criminal Law Division podcast. The Criminal Law Division of Legal Aid New South Wales acknowledges the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as the traditional custodians of the land and waters. We acknowledge this podcast is recorded on Aboriginal land and pay our respect to elders past and present. We extend that respect to First Nations listeners joining us here today.
Welcome back to the Five Cases podcast. This is episode 8, recorded on the 29th of April, 2024. I'm Paul Cody.
And I'm Caitlin Akhtar of Forbes Chambers, and we're speaking to you from Gadigal land.
Caitlin, what are you going to deal with today?
Well, I have two very important decisions on bail to update you on. Bugmy and the Director of Public Prosecutions, New South Wales, 2024, New South Wales CA 70. And R&RB 2024 New South Wales SC 471. But I also have a decision about automatism and liability for driving offences in a case of El Saidi and R 2021 New South Wales CCA 303. How about you, Paul?
Thanks, Caitlin. I'd like to go to one High Court case which is relatively dated now from 2023, but is becoming increasingly relevant. And that's the case of Lang and the Queen from 2023. And the second case I'd like to go to relates to the relevance of parole, whether a person will get parole on sentence. Caitlin, bail comes first. After you.
Thanks, Paul. Well, this is a decision about the Bail Act and what police should do when they suspect there's been a breach of bail. So that's a decision of Bugmy and the Director of Public Prosecutions, New South Wales, 2024. New South Wales CA 70, and it was an appeal brought to the Court of Appeal, so different to the Court of Criminal Appeal, and the Senior Public Defender, Belinda Rigg, Senior Counsel, appeared in it. Now, it's a case that's, I have to say, quite important for me because when I was working in the Coffs Harbour Office of Legal Aid, we, that is the team and I, were faced really frequently with children who were locked up overnight on a breach of bail for really very, very minor breaches of the bail, where we often lamented that there didn't seem to be much thought given to the alternative ways of dealing with a breach of bail that are provided for in Section 77 of the Bail Act. Now, this is a case of Ms. Julie Bugmy, who was charged with resisting an officer in the execution of his duty, which is contrary to Section 58 of the Crimes Act. Ms. Bugmy effectively argued that she was not guilty of resisting an officer in the execution of his duty because the officer was not in his duty as he was unlawfully arresting her for a breach of bail. It wasn't contested in that case that the police officer who arrested Ms. Bugmy didn't consider the alternatives to arrest that are provided in Section 77 of the Bail Act. He left Broken Hill Police Station with the intention of arresting Ms. Bugmy, and it was the first thing he sought to do upon arriving at the residence. And the court considered whether the fact that the Act requires a police officer to think about the alternatives to arresting someone for a breach of bail means that if the police don't do that is if they don't think about the alternatives to arrest for a breach of bail, then they're actually unlawfully arresting a person, and therefore if the person resists, they're not guilty of the offence of resisting an officer in the execution of duty. Now, one of the things said, paragraph 41, was, it is scarcely surprising to observe that before a police officer can take any of the actions in section 77(1), the officer must first form the view that the action is an appropriate one. He also said that there was a difference between a police officer who arrests someone without warrant under section 99 of LEPRA, for example, if they suspect them of committing an offence, as opposed to arresting them for a breach of bail under section 77, that those powers are actually different. And that's something I confess I hadn't really turned my mind to before. So there's an interesting discussion about that comparison at paragraph 42 of the judgment. So I'd encourage anybody who's dealing with this kind of an issue, which is an arrest on a breach of bail and then charges of resisting arrest or assaulting police in execution of duty that might come up as a consequence of that, to have a look at whether the arrest was lawful and whether the police did consider the alternatives that they're required to because of section 77 of the Act. So that's the important case of Bugmy. The other bail decision, which has very recently been published, it was published on Friday, the 26th of April, is a decision by Justice Lonergan in the Supreme Court for a young person who was applying for bail, and it was initially thought that they were subject to this brand new provision that's been brought in, 22C of the Bail Act, which is a specific and additional hurdle that's placed upon children who are seeking bail, which is a pretty new and novel kind of concept. So effectively, this young person, RB, he at the time of the decision will turn 18 in 4 months, so he's very close to being an adult. What the court agreed in the end was that because both the original offence that he was on bail for and the offence that he was arrested for in terms of breaching his bail, they both happened before Section 22C came in. And so by the end of the hearing, they decided that 22C didn't apply. That was for very technical reasons. And anybody who's dealing with a 22C case should read that case carefully to work out whether their case is one that falls within 22C or not. But there are two other things that are very important about this case. The first is that Justice Lonergan said that because 22C was a big focus of the hearing, that she made some further observations about it. She accepted they were over to dicta, but still I think they were very important. Justice Lonergan said she wished to make some observations about it. This is at paragraph 53, including a concern that it operates in an unfairly discriminatory way upon a section of the community, children aged 14 to under 18, who have been widely and specifically recognised as a group that needs support and guidance, not incarceration and disconnection from their family and the community. She also says 22C now provides for a higher bar, referred to in the second reading speech somewhat coyly as an additional threshold, than the regime which applies to adults in exactly the same circumstances, which is an observation that's been really prominently made by a lot of people in the legal community. She says Section 22C has the effect of singling out a group of persons, children, alleged to have committed certain as yet unproved offences and requiring that they satisfy a higher test of uncertain meaning and application before they can be released on bail. And Her Honour also says that adults, perhaps who have a terrible record, do not have to demonstrate anything that would inform the court to a high degree of confidence about any matter at all. Her Honour concludes by saying that she's highlighting a lack of coherence between the bail court's obligations to comply with sections 4 and 6 of the Children Criminal Proceedings Act, and those sections include an observation that children shouldn't be worse off than adults in the criminal justice system, and the requirements of section 22C, which treats a relevantly charged child's freedom in a less favourable way than an adult's freedom in exactly the same circumstances. And Her Honour refers to Section 14 of the Age Discrimination Act 2004, which is a Commonwealth provision about age discrimination. Now, there's one further thing that I think is relevant and helpful from Her Honour's judgment, and that is an observation about police views letters, which seem to persist despite some judicial commentary doubting their usefulness. Her Honour says, letters from police officers involved in the investigation of criminal offences, where they provide updated factual material or recent court outcomes not otherwise known, might be helpful. What is not useful nor helpful are letters full of accusations or generalities and conclusions rather than facts. And she also says that the views of the police about what the court should do about bail are also not helpful. Her Honour says there needs to be care taken in the form and structure of material placed before the court. Conclusions that a person is lying or unspecified telephone conversations and assertions about what they mean for criminal activity will be ignored and have in this case been ignored and should not be put before the court in that form. So quite a strident and articulate, in my view, judgment by Her Honour about bail and some associated issues about bail. And I'd encourage anybody who is dealing with a 22C case or really dealing with the bail for children generally to read that case. I think it's a very useful one. Hopefully we'll hear more about it.
Thanks, Caitlin. Interesting developments in bail law. I want to move to trial law. The decision I'm looking at today is a High Court decision of 2023, and it is Lang and the Queen. And the reason I wanted to deal with a slightly dated case like this is twofold. First, it's a fantastic decision on expert evidence. And if you've ever struggled with the admissibility or otherwise of an expert report, you can take heart after reading this decision because the High Court clearly struggled with it as well. Second of all, this decision is becoming more relevant recently as practitioners deal in all level of court with the admissibility of expert reports in relation to mental illness. And that's something I want to address at the end of this case summary. First of all, the facts in Lang and the Queen. The appellant in Lang was convicted of murder. The deceased was his domestic partner, who was found with stab wounds to her stomach. The issue at trial was whether the stab wounds were self-inflicted or inflicted by the appellant. The Crown relied upon the evidence of an expert forensic pathologist as to the nature of the wounds that he observed on the deceased's body. Two appeal grounds were raised in the High Court, the first of unreasonableness, and second, the issue of the admissibility of the expert evidence. And in relation to the expert evidence ground, the High Court split. The Chief Justice, Justices Gageler and Jago, ruled that the forensic pathologist's evidence was admissible and the conviction should stand. Justices Gordon and Edelman disagreed, held that the expert evidence was wrongly admitted and would have ordered a retrial after not admitting the evidence. So how was it that the High Court split on this issue? One factor should be noted from the outset, that this is a decision that reached the High Court from the Queensland Court of Appeal. While the Uniform Evidence Act does not apply there, the Court acknowledged that the same principles applied in the analysis at common law as they do under the Evidence Act. So if you're met with any type of criticism by an opponent or by the court in relation to this being a relevantly Queensland case, your rejoinder is that the same principles apply. First, Justices Gordon and Edelman gave a fantastic summary of the fundamental requirements for the admissibility of expert evidence, and they can be summarised in these three ways. First, expert evidence must identify an accepted field of expertise which they have, which they can apply to the facts. Second, the expert must identify a factual basis or foundation for the opinion in the admissible evidence. And third, the expert must display how their expertise is the substantial basis connecting the factual foundation to the opinion given. The expert in this case was a forensic pathologist. He had conducted between 4,000 to 5,000 autopsies in his career. And so the High Court justices unanimously agreed that he was an expert who was entitled to give expert opinion evidence. He gave evidence that the stab wound was more likely caused by a second person rather than being self-inflicted. Again, he set out the basis of his opinion, and that allowed for cross-examination. The difference between the judges' approaches was that the minority were of the view that the forensic pathologist's expertise was not sufficiently connected with the opinion that he expressed, that is, the third fundamental requirement was not reached. And that was because even with his extensive experience of 4,000 to 5,000 autopsies, he accepted that he had never seen stab wounds similar to the ones in this case that include multiple tracks within the same wound, and what appeared to be a rotation of the knife in the same wound. He stated that he found the wound odd, unusual, and gave the opinion that it would have been painful to self-inflict. And it was these three elements that formed the difference between the approaches of the judges. Justices Gordon and Edelman were of the view that none of those matters had any connection with his expertise, and they likened it to a paediatrician giving evidence on matters of psychology. That is, he simply wasn't qualified to give that opinion. In contrast, the majority in separate judgments was of the view that the expert could bring to bear all of his expertise in assessing the odd and potential unusual status of these injuries. He was sufficiently qualified to reason from his expertise, using the admissible facts to provide his opinion. The case really is a masterclass on the admissibility of expert evidence and its potential limitations. Both the majority and minority decisions give useful history of the admissibility of expert evidence and its limitations, and helpfully they also outline the cross-examination that was deployed against the expert in an attempt to undermine the basis of his opinion. Now, I stated that there was a second reason I wish to highlight this case, and that's an issue that many practitioners have come across perhaps more recently and that is the admissibility of the diagnosis of mental illness by psychologists. There seems to be differences of opinion in New South Wales courts as to whether psychologists can indeed diagnose mental illness through expert reports. In the background, this is something that the public defenders are working on with the Australian Psychological Society, and we're hoping to have a formal document published this year for admission into court proceedings. However, in the interim, last year, the Australian Psychological Society published a circular on their website about diagnosis. And from that professional body's perspective, it will depend on the particular training and expertise of each site psychologist, whether or not they hold additional endorsements such as clinical or forensic to their name, and whether they have specific training in those additional endorsements. So effectively, apply the Evidence Act. There's no across-the-board answer. The psychologist must be endorsed by the Australian Psychological Society, but your psychologist does not need to be a clinical or a forensic psychologist to offer an opinion on mental illness. It will depend on that individual psychologist's training, education and experience. So should you face a magistrate or a judge who will not admit such an opinion, I would arm myself with first, a copy of the High Court decision in Lang, and second, a copy of the circular from the Australian Psychological Society, which we'll place on the show notes, and tender those in your argument.
That's fantastic, and I can't wait to go and read that case now as well. I have a case about automatism, which is a reasonably rare defence, I think, although I've had a couple recently. And the case citation is L. Saidi and R., 2021, New South Wales CCA 303. You can tell by that citation that the judgment itself is of some age, but it was only recently published, probably because whatever happened to Mr. L. Saidi is now finalised. It's a case where Mr. L. Saidi was tried and convicted of charges of dangerous driving occasioning death and also dangerous driving occasioning grievous bodily harm. And those two charges reflect, unfortunately, the outcomes for both the passengers in the car that he was driving. And Mr. L. Saidi was driving a car and struck the rear of a parked ute, effectively. There was evidence that he was speeding, and there was also tendency evidence that he had a tendency to speed and overtake dangerously before the jury. There was evidence that tramadol and diazepam detected in his blood would be expected to occasion significant impairment, but his case was that he suffered from an epileptic seizure immediately prior to the accident. So there was undisputed evidence that after the accident, he suffered from epilepsy. And then there was an issue at trial about whether he had an epileptic seizure immediately prior to the collision. So the Crown's expert witness said that it was possible but unlikely that the accident was explained by a seizure. And the defence expert opined that the observations of the appellant after the accident were consistent with an epileptic seizure. So the Crown put its case primarily on the basis that he drove dangerously with a combination of speed, failing to keep a proper lookout, and ingesting a combination of drugs. And this issue about epilepsy raised an issue about whether he was driving voluntarily, because if he wasn't driving voluntarily, then Crown's not able to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, what the jury were directed in the summing up just before they went out on verdict is that they had to consider whether they were satisfied beyond reasonable doubt that Mr. El Saidi lost control of the car because he lost consciousness by suffering a seizure. And they were also directed that they could take certain steps if they found beyond reasonable doubt that he did suffer from a seizure just before the impact. So those two are direct quotes from the directions to the jury. But as the Court of Criminal Appeals said, it was for the Crown to prove that the driving was voluntary at the time of the impact, and if not, to prove that the driving was voluntary and dangerous immediately before it became involuntary. So that was the legal test that applied. So the jury shouldn't have been directed in terms that suggested that they had to be satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that the appellant had suffered from a seizure. So those directions were wrong at law. The Crown ultimately conceded that they were wrong at law because they suggested the jury were required to choose between these competing submissions about whether it was voluntary or involuntary, and that isn't correct. And it's a good case to take note of if you've got somebody who says that they can't remember or they don't think it was voluntary or something of that nature, and particularly if they have epilepsy, like a recent case that I had, that the law about that is quite technical and complicated, but it will be for the Crown to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, if some evidence is raised about voluntariness, that the person was acting voluntarily. And if that's not investigated, it might be that you're kind of overlooking a defence that applies. So pretty interesting case to consider, I think.
Thanks, Caitlin. I always struggle with the issue of automatism, and I'm pretty certain that most psychiatrists and psychologists do too. It's an area that perhaps the law has not kept pace with modern developments in psychology and psychiatry. The final decision we want to deal with today is a very short one. It's a sentencing decision from the Court of Criminal Appeal, and that's Hattahet, H-A-T-A-H-E-T. It's a 2023 decision, but again, it's becoming more relevant. And it deals with the very simple issue, is the fact that an offender is unlikely to be granted parole relevant on sentence? Traditionally, the answer to this has been no, as courts have considered parole decisions to be those exclusively of the executive. And further, the offenders have no expectation or entitlement to parole, and therefore it can't be a relevant consideration on sentence. However, in Hattahet, the circumstances on sentence were a little different. The criminal offence that the offender pleaded guilty to related to engaging in hostile activity in a foreign country. Section 19ALB of the Commonwealth Crimes Act states that the Attorney General must not make a parole order for people convicted of such offences unless there are exceptional circumstances. And on sentence, the appellant's representatives tendered the statistics showing that in fact the Attorney General had not ever granted parole for someone to whom Section 19ALB applied, making the likelihood of parole very unlikely indeed. The Court of Criminal Appeal considered that the legislative hurdle in Section 19ALB in granting parole in these class of cases required different considerations to come into play, and the court should not overlook the practical outcomes that offenders sentenced for this class of offence were most unlikely to get parole. Justice Baston, with whom the other justices agreed, held this legislative provision made the prospects of custody more onerous, leading to resentence and eventual mitigation of the sentence. The reason this decision, which was handed down last year, has become more relevant is that the Crown has been granted special leave to appeal from this decision, and the matter is set down for hearing in the High Court in mid-May 2024. So we'll give you an update once this decision is handed down, probably in the next podcast.
How exciting. Thanks, everybody, for your time today, and we'll look forward to getting back to you next month with some more cases.